Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to an even more exciting than usual edition of History Hack. That is appalling grammar, which is quite kind of unapt or inapt, or basically I'm just showing that I'm inept. Charlie, why am I stuttering over my words and why am I flustered about today's guest?
Oh dear, Zach. Zach is fanboying quite appropriately because today we are joined by Alison Weir. She is the best-selling author and historian who has published over 30 books, selling over 3 million copies worldwide. You might know her from her Six Tudor Queens series of novels. You hopefully know her from her wonderful new book, Elizabeth of York, The Last White Rose. And that's what she's come in very kindly to speak to us about today. Hello, Alison.
Hello, Charlie.
Thank you so much for joining us. As I mentioned before, we're all big fans. We're all readers. So we're very much looking forward to chatting to you.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a great pleasure.
So Elizabeth of York, what do we know about her early life to set the scene? We know she's the sister of the princes in the Tower, ill-fated. Yes. So I guess she must have been quite at risk during those Wars of the Roses.
Well, yes, during them, and her childhood was stable, her very early childhood was quite stable until her father was forced to flee. Her father was King Edward IV, and he'd emerged victorious over the House of Lancaster in 1461. She was born in 1466. But in 1470, her father had alienated the powerful Earl of Warwick, Warwick the Kingmaker, who'd helped to put him on the throne. And Warwick had risen against him and literally ousted him from the throne. This is why it was called the Kingmaker, and helped to restore and put back Henry VI of the House of Lancaster on the throne. And Edward fled abroad. So Elizabeth's life was completely thrown into turmoil at this point, because with her mother and her little sisters, her mother fled into sanctuary with her young family in Westminster Abbey. So Elizabeth was a fugitive, basically, at the age of four. And then her father came back and was victorious. Shire after shire fell to him, and he came back to London. There was a joyful reunion. And the Queen was able to present him with his firstborn son, who'd been born in sanctuary. And the chroniclers tell us it was a loving reunion. But then just after that, one of the most dramatic events of Elizabeth's young life happened, or perhaps her whole life, because she was still kept in the Tower for safety while her father rode off to ultimately defeat the Earl of Warwick and the Lancastrians. And while he was away, the Tower was bombarded by a Lancastrian faction. It must have been terrifying. And they were fought off. But for a young child, you can just imagine what the noise and the fear must have been like.
Gosh. And of course, she's got all those younger siblings as well. Yes. In there.
She's the oldest of 10.
Oh my
and
goodness.
Five girls survived. At this point, there are three of them. And then, of course, her two younger brothers, the one born in the sanctuary was the future Edward V, and then Richard, Duke of York, followed 3 years later.
So they were in sanctuary for that long?
No. They were in sanctuary from about October, November 1470 until the spring of 1471.
Wow.
But of course they ended up in sanctuary again, because when Elizabeth was 16, her father was, no, 17 actually, her father died prematurely. And the throne went passed to his son, who became Edward V at the age of 12. And Edward IV's brother, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, became Lord Protector. But within a very short time, within a time of a couple of months, 3 months, he had seized the crown The two princes who had been living in the palace of the tower, which was perfectly normal in those days prior to a coronation, they disappeared from sight and were never seen again. And the Richard Duke of Gloucester had been crowned Richard III. And as soon as Richard of Gloucester had heard of his brother's death, he seized the young king. And at that point, Elizabeth Woodville, the queen, took her daughters and her younger son into sanctuary. And so they were in sanctuary again. They were in sanctuary for a year.
Gosh.
It's a dramatic story.
I can't imagine going through all of that in your still even just a teenager.
Well, not just that, because, I mean, Elizabeth had been betrothed some years before her father died. She'd been betrothed to the Dauphin of France, the heir to France. She was going to be Queen of France. And this was a very grand marriage. She was addressed as Madame la Dauphine, and she was given gowns in the French fashion, taught French, of course. And, you know, she was going to be a very great lady. No English princess has ever been a Queen of France before, since the Norman Conquest. And then she was very publicly jilted. So she had been a princess of the highest estate. But then suddenly, under her uncle, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, she and her siblings were declared bastards because he said he had evidence to show that Edward IV had been married to another woman when he married their mother. But there's no evidence there. He never produced the evidence. The matter was never laid before an ecclesiastical court. And it was just left to Parliament to just declare that the marriage was invalid, which Parliament actually didn't have the authority to do. And so Elizabeth not only lost her father, was in sanctuary, but she was declared a bastard. She ceased to be a princess and of political importance. But of course, there were those who realised that as soon as her brothers had disappeared and there were rumours that they had been murdered, that as the eldest of the daughter of the family, she was the natural heiress of England.
Gosh.
I'm slightly staggered by all of that. I'm not sure how you come through that as a kind of functioning human being, going from all of those highs to those lows and then back and forth, and just being thrown into war zones like that as a kid, having to deal with, you know, your home being bombarded and then you're fleeing again and you come back and everything's all right and then it's not. It's horrific.
A huge amount of fortune, and it actually brought out, I think, the feistiness in her, which we never see again after she became queen, because there is evidence, and it's all controversial, there is evidence, which I think is of sound foundation, that she actually pushed. I mean, it was clear that Richard III was interested in marrying her. Now, a slight problem was that he was already married. But he'd also got his sights on a divorce, and it's pretty obvious his wife was very ill and was dying, probably tuberculosis, we don't know for certain. But he wanted to marry her, but she was his niece. You can imagine public feeling about this. But it looks as if Elizabeth actually herself pushed for this marriage. And people say, why would she do that? Why would she try to marry the man who was rumoured to have murdered her brothers? So he could seize the throne, the man who had her declared a bastard. Well, think of it like this. She and her mother and her younger sisters are all in sanctuary. They have no future there. The abbey is surrounded by a ring of steel because they're not allowed to get out because Richard's terrified that she would go abroad and you know, marry some foreign prince and they would invade England and get rid of him. And Henry Tudor, of course, is, you know, this sprig of the House of Lancaster is claiming the English throne through her. And he's an exile on the continent at this time. But she thought this was the only way to assure a future for herself and her mother and her sisters was actually by becoming queen. And therefore, it looks as if she pushed for this. But Richard's advisors were absolutely horrified. They could see, I mean, he'd already lost a lot of support because of the rumours about the princes. And they could see what was going to happen. And as soon as his wife died in March 1485, they warned him, you cannot do this. And he publicly rejected the idea. And hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And we have another controversial source that describes how Elizabeth secretly plotted to abet Henry Tudor and aid his bid to invade England and take the throne.
This is exactly where I wanted to go next with this, because I mean, in the notes, I just kind of put a very simple question of why marry Henry?
Henry was the best option for her. because although Henry, a lot of Richard III had said he was, you know, this, called him an unknown Welshman who'd been born in double or come from double adultery. He was referring to scandals way back in the royal line, back to the time of John of Gaunt and Edward III, from whom Henry was descended. But Henry was the only viable Lancastrian candidate. And he was, and many, if you say, you know, that the, when he went to Rennes Cathedral on Christmas Day 1483 and publicly vowed to take the realm of England and then marry Elizabeth, who legitimists would have argued was the rightful queen anyway, 500 Yorkists had been disaffected and were there sitting in there supporting him. And that gives you some idea of how many prominent people had been alienated from Richard. So Henry represented for Elizabeth a stable future, the reversal of her bastardy, and the fact he would stand for legitimacy.
Gosh, doesn't it just show how the fortunes of women at this time are so intricately bound with the fortunes of the men protect them? So what's her married life like? We know she has a lot of children, but is it a happy marriage?
Seven children. And most of the evidence shows that this was a very happy and stable and supportive marriage. She was the perfect medieval queen. She was fruitful, pious, charitable, gentle, and she graced every ceremony with great elegance and aplomb. And she was very much loved. I mean, her privy purse accounts, which sadly only survived for the last year of her life, show numerous gifts from common people. When she travelled, they came to the palace. They brought her, chickens and cherries in season and things like that. She was much, much loved. And when she died, there was a huge outpouring of mourning, comparable probably to what happened when Princess Diana died.
Gosh, I guess that's because she's the Yorkist heir, isn't she? You could say whatever you wanted to do.
She was the Yorkist heir of the old royal line. But Henry VII, of course, would never acknowledge her to be that, because he deliberately held off marrying her until A, he'd been crowned, and B, he'd obtained a dispensation for the marriage that could perhaps have been expedited earlier. But he wanted to make it clear that he held the crown by right of conquest and simply because he now was king. It was a fact, so Parliament has confirmed it. He did not want it said that he owed his crown to his wife and he reigned in her right. But it was left to Henry VIII, their son, many years later to say that, yes, the crown came to him through his mother. He acknowledged that. But this legitimacy was very important for Henry, and Henry's later biographer Francis Bacon, who was writing well over a century later, was so angry with Henry for ignoring Elizabeth's title to the throne, he tried to paint this marriage in as dismal terms as possible. But the contemporary evidence does not support that. There's one account by an ambassador. They describe her looking as miserable and downtrodden. Well, yes, actually, she was worried sick about a pretender who was claiming to be one of her brothers who was threatening her husband's throne. And she was also very ill in early pregnancy. And so that could account for the way she was when he actually saw her. But all the other evidence shows that this was a very happy marriage and a fruitful one and a marriage of partners, of cooperation.
He's quite frugal, isn't he? Henry VII is known as being a bit tight. Yes,
but he also knew, he understood the Renaissance, the contemporary concept of magnificence, because that's how monarchs were judged, by how splendid you were, you know, and how majestic you were. So he knew when to outlay money on that. He could be quite parsimonious in other ways. In fact, you know, I remember there's a lovely little anecdote of he used to check all his own accounts and everything. And he had a pet monkey and it managed to chew up his account book. And the courtiers thought this was wonderful because he was really, you know, seen as an old miser. He was careful. He'd learned in a hard school. And it's touching. I remember there's a wonderful television series that captures this perfectly, that Elizabeth's account, her privy purse accounts, she has to repair her shoes with tin buckles, and they make something of this when she dies. And she's always short of money, and he's quite careful, keeps her on a tight rein in a way, because I think that he still saw her as the House of York, whereas he was the House of Lancaster. Although they had united with the red and the white rose, there is perhaps this little sort of tension in the marriage in that respect. But she never, once she becomes queen, after all these intrigues beforehand, she loses her voice. We don't hear from her. We got the odd letter, and they're very formal letters, just what you would expect from a queen, but nothing. She's clearly, I think, quite content, and she's achieved what she wanted to achieve.
That's really interesting, because I was literally, I mean, you're preempting all of my questions, which is brilliant.
Sorry.
No, that's great. I mean, basically, I can just sit here and lap all of this up, which is absolutely what I'm doing. But I'm curious about that ability to influence events going on around her, in part because I have this image in my head, certainly one that comes from a portrait of her in later life, of this very, I mean, you've said already, a very pious woman. That certainly comes through in this image that I've seen, but also quite a formidable looking woman, somebody who doesn't look as though...
That doesn't come across to me. No, okay. I would say the word is more gentle, actually. I mean, we're not talking about... I mean, Agnes Strickland wrote her Lives of the Queens of England in Victorian times, and you think they're all wilting flowers to read her descriptions of them. But you had to be tough to a degree, you know, to survive in Renaissance courts. And courts were places of intrigue, but Elizabeth stayed aloof from that. But we do find instances of her exerting some influence in private, and Henry consulting her, firstly on things like their children's marriages. Now, traditionally, queens had a right to be consulted, a right to be involved, because they played the female role, welcoming a bride for a son, looking after a daughter's trousseau. And they had a duty, as it were, to make sure their children were making good marriages or had good educations and that. So yes, he did. But what we can't quantify is the influence that queens often wielded in private, because that's just not what happens in the bedchamber. It's not recorded. So we don't know, but we do know that on one occasion Henry took Elizabeth into his confidence about that when her brother-in-law, one of her sister's husbands, was going to be arrested for treason. And she clearly was very unhappy about this. Her sister was devastated. Elizabeth did a lot to support her while her husband was in the Tower. But definitely Henry trusted her. This is towards the end of their marriage.
Gosh, this is, I'm going to have to take a detour from Zach's very carefully written notes here, Alison, and ask you about some of the other women who are around. Okay. She's got her mother. She also has the mother-in-law of all mother-in-laws.
Margaret Beaufort. Now,
how did she get on with Maggie B?
Why do you say that? Because why does Margaret Beaufort have such a bad press? According to her chaplain, John Fisher, all who knew her loved her. Now, clearly, she was a formidable lady. I wouldn't have liked to be one of her tenants who got on the wrong side of her and defaulted on rent, basically. But there are all sorts of ridiculous stories going around that she was the one who took out the princes in the Tower, and it all stems from a television drama documentary from, I think, the 1990s. And there isn't one contemporary source that accuses Margaret Beaufort of being involved. There's one vague 17th century source that said they'd seen a book somewhere that said it recorded that it was her. And I thought, well, actually, that's not what you would call evidence. It's far too late in the day. Margaret clearly got on well with Elizabeth. They worked in concert for various things. When it was proposed that Elizabeth's daughter, Margaret Tudor, was to marry the King of Scots, both she and Margaret Beaufort put pressure on the king not to let her marry too young because of what had happened to Margaret Beaufort, who'd married at 12 and born her first child, her only child, at 13, and was clearly damaged by it in one way or another. So they worked in concert, and they were often together. And I think Elizabeth welcomed this very kindly guidance from her mother-in-law and was clearly good with her. So I don't know where all this bad press for Margaret Beaufort is coming from.
I think she was a very formidable woman. I certainly wouldn't have wanted her as a mother-in-law.
I'm not so sure. I mean, reading about her, you know, and what she, how, what an interest, how much she loved her grandchildren, and how careful she was for them, and how she, you know, she seems to have been good with the family.
I'm keen to delve a little bit more into sort of the family and just start to think about her sons for a moment. I mean, this is the woman she gives birth to Henry VIII.
Yes, she does.
And, you know, Henry VIII, like him or loathe him, another formidable individual in many senses.
Yes.
So I guess there are two kind of initial questions that I have here. One, to what extent do you see Elizabeth's character replicated in Henry? Because Henry obviously changes over the course of his life quite substantially.
Oh, yes, he does. Yeah.
But also, what do we know about what she thought about her son, Henry VIII?
We don't know a lot about that. We just know that she, you know, she was a devoted mother. And it looks as if she was very close to Henry. There was a tradition at this time established by the House of York that the heir was sent away to Ludlow Castle on the edge of the Welsh border, on the Welsh border, to learn the art of kingship, you know, while by nominally governing his Principality of Wales with the help of a council. That had happened to Elizabeth's own brother, Edward V, and it happened to her eldest son, Arthur. And the eldest son was always associated with the king as the heir. It was the second son, it had happened with Richard, Duke of York, it happened with Henry VIII, who was associated with his mother and was brought up near the court or in the court sometimes. And we can tell Elizabeth was pretty close to young Henry VIII because David Starkey has compared their handwriting, and it's quite clear Elizabeth taught him to write. And that's quite hands-on for a medieval queen. As I said earlier, medieval queens, their duty was to ensure that their children were well looked after, that they had a good education, and that they married well. But they didn't do the day-to-day mothering. But in this case, it's quite clear that there was some sort of day-to-day hands-on mothering. And particularly, she took a role in his education. So definitely from that point of view, I think they were close.
I mean, could this be because Henry was, you know, for all intents and purposes, the spare at the beginning of his life? He wasn't.
I have a theory in the book, and it is only a theory, but Arthur was premature. And for the first, at least between 6 months and 2 years of his life, he was born at Winchester. He was kept at Farnham Castle because he was frail. And he was frail from birth because of this prematurity. And in those days, premature children, I mean, there was an increased chance of dying in childhood or a serious illness. And we know from references that, you know, in the Spanish diplomatic calendar, that Arthur was sickly before Catherine of Aragon ever came to England. And also prematurity and separation from the mother can have an effect on the relationship, the bonding between mother and son. Now, we don't know that this happened in this case, but I've used it theoretically as a theme in the novel. Henry, of course, was a healthy baby and was brought up with his mother with his mother or near his mother in the palaces in the Thames Valley from the start. And so I think there was a closer relationship. And the evidence for it being a close relationship, not just the educational side, is that Henry genuinely grieved for his mother when she died. He was 11 and he not quite 11. And it was discovered only recently, there's a manuscript called the Vox Passionale in the National Library of Wales in Cardiff. And it shows Henry VII enthroned one side, and on the other side there's this exquisite little miniature showing a black-draped mourning bed, an empty mourning bed, clearly for Elizabeth of York. And sitting on the rug in front of a fire before it are two little princesses, Mary and Margaret. And kneeling by the bed with his head in his hands is a little red-headed boy, and that's Henry crying for his mother. And we have a letter from Henry written on the death of the Archduke Philip, his brother-in-law. He will be his brother-in-law when he married Catherine of Aragon. It's Catherine Aragon's brother-in-law. And he said, "Never since the death of my dear mother have I received such hateful intelligence," or something like words to that effect. Clearly, he adored his mother. And she died when he was perhaps too young to have seen her as a rounded human being with faults and failings. Maybe he idealized her, and maybe she was the benchmark against which he measured all other women, notably his six wives.
That's a pretty tantalizing thought right there.
And you can see why Catherine of Aragon conforms to that. She is the perfect medieval queen in every way, apart from the fact she can't give him a son. And Anne Boleyn doesn't conform to anything like that. Jane Seymour does. She's the complete antithesis of Anne Boleyn. But Catherine of Aragon, you could say, was our last medieval queen. But she is the image of Elizabeth of York, apart from the fertility aspect.
Can I ask about the predecessor, the King Arthur, if you like, that England never got? Because he died shortly before she did. So how does she cope with that personal tragedy?
Well, we have a very touching account, one of the few sort of intimate accounts of a king and queen in their personal lives, because the news was Arthur died at Ludlow Castle, and the news was brought to Henry by his confessor. And he came to him in the night and told him that, you know, if we receive good things from the hand of God, we must also receive, you know, bad things or whatever. And he told him, your dearest son is departed to God. And Henry was absolutely broken, crushed. And they sent for Elizabeth to comfort him. And she put her own grief aside and she comforted him. And she said, you've got to bear in mind in this case that the year before she had born a son, but she had been, 2 years before she had born a son. And her life had been feared for during her pregnancy because she was so ill. And she hadn't conceived since. And she said to Henry when he was grieving, she said, remember, God is still where he was and we are both young enough. And then, of course, when she went back to her own chamber, it just hit her. And he was summoned and he comforted her as well. And this is such a touching account, you know, and I've really reproduced it almost word for word in the novel. But I do think there is some evidence, little bits of evidence, if you put them together, it suggests that some months later there was a bit of a rift between them. But I don't think it's to do with Arthur's death. I think it's to do with Henry's arrest of the husband of Elizabeth's sister. And also because another sister was banished from court for making a second marriage without the king's permission. And I don't think Elizabeth was very pleased with Henry about that. And one might wonder, given the testimony of the doctors, that why Henry allowed Arthur to leave London and travel to Ludlow in the depth of winter when he was so ill. Did she hold that against him? We don't know. There's so much we don't know. That's what's so sad about this subject. So a lot of it, you just have to go down the route when you're writing a novel, what you think is the likeliest, the reality of it.
That brings us on to a question that we have to ask you about having you here, Alison, and that's to ask you about your craft as an author and many challenges you must face in bringing a period to life. How do you go about giving voices to perhaps quieter women in your novels whose letters aren't there and the documents aren't there? How do you do that?
Well, you have to go on what is there. And you have to look at their letters, you have to look as much as possible so you can find a voice for them. In Elizabeth's case, there is the letter on which her pushing for the marriage to Richard III is based. Mm. There's also the ballad called The Song of Lady Bessie, which details the effort she may well have made to assist Henry Tudor's invasion. And these, she's quite feisty. And this is why she becomes so quiet afterwards. And yet if you haven't got documentation, you look at actions and you infer what you can from that. And so I think, I mean, having sort of studied her on and off since, I'll wait for this, the 1960s, I think, you know, I can get an approximation. I'm not going to be ever claim that I know Elizabeth of York. How can we at this distance in time? But I think you have to go with what you think is the best evidence.
Do you think being a historian in some ways is a bit of a curse when it comes to, yes, to being a novelist?
I think my publishers might think that sometimes. It's a bit academic. I remember when I first wrote my first novel, and I only wrote it for fun. It was just one of the several projects I undertook in just my spare time, just to see if I could write fiction, because I'd written it years before and nothing I wanted published. And I liked it at the end. I showed it to my agent. He said, it's great stuff, great story. He said, but it's faction. You've got to stop being a historian and start being a novelist and get off the fence. So I put it in a drawer. A few years later, I had a gap between books and I went back and rewrote it. Wrote it in the first person present tense. No history books written in that way. But I've learned with every single book, I've learned to show rather than tell. I've learned to, you don't just say Elizabeth was angry. You show her being angry, like she clenches her fist. You know, the reader's got to see it. And there are various ways you can do that, but it took me quite a while to grasp that.
That's fantastic.
Do you have any sort of writer's regrets? I want to keep kind of going with this kind of other half of the story, because I think it's very rare to get somebody who has researched this. Obviously, all historical novelists have to research, but you are a historian as well as a historical novelist. And I'm really interested in that perspective, so I want to keep probing. But do you have any sort of writer's regrets across your novels? Are there any things that you've done or you've written that you've gone?
Not so much my novels, my history books. I had published a book called Henry VIII, King and Court in 2001. Mm. And I, it's from, I've inferred from various historical sources that there was a possibility that Anne Boleyn was pregnant at the time she was beheaded, and that Henry VIII didn't know this, and that, but it's too slender. I mean, I didn't come on, I hope, too strongly in the book, but my goodness, the press pounced on it. And I got eminent historians ringing me up saying, why are you saying this? I wish to goodness I hadn't. And there was a time I wrote a novel called The Lady Elizabeth, and came out in 2008. And of course, Elizabeth I was claimed to be the Virgin Queen. And I think she was right, actually. I think the evidence strongly suggests that, but would like one day to write a book about that on its own. But I had her having a legitimate baby in this book. And oh my goodness, outrage from readers. Why have you done this when you've said in history books, you think she was a virgin queen? It's basically a what if. Because there is some evidence, and it's circumstantial or not good evidence, but it's there. If it wasn't there, I wouldn't be making much of it.
And as a novelist, you can explore that. You can ask what if.
As a novelist, you can explore a what if. And I always write a long author's note in the end of a book to explain what's fact and what's fiction, why I've gone with the storylines. But I do sometimes I think people don't see that. They actually email me before they finish the book and got there. Or I'm not sure it actually shows up on ebooks. I'm not sure whether author's notes are included, because some people have said they haven't seen it. So, I think it's essential to do that if you're writing historical novels, because I know from feedback and from audiences at events that people care, that they're getting the history from a historical novel. They want to know it's quite accurate. Well, I actually fictionalise a historical narrative. I wrote a biography of Elizabeth that was published in 2013, and that was my base. So I just literally fictionalised it. But I added, of course, embellished it as well with the fictional bits. But I don't go too far. I go only as far as I think is credible. Although some might disagree when it comes to Richard III, but I'm not going to tell you where I'm going with Richard III in this particular book.
Am I going to be upset, Alison?
Your mother might be. Oh, dear. I hope I've been fair to him, put it like that. But of course, Elizabeth doesn't know. This is one of the big questions of her life. Yeah. The fate of the princes in the tower is crucial to her own life, to her own fate, and what happens to her illegitimacy. And what did she think? We know that she adored her brothers and sisters. We've got good testimony from that, from contemporary sources. And how did she feel? What must it have been like to know her brothers had just disappeared, to have to deal with her mother, who was in a terrible state about it? And to think that her uncle, to whom she probably admired and was, I wouldn't say close, because he wasn't always at court, but she obviously there was something between them. Because we know they shared books. But how did she feel about this? It must have been a nightmare for her. And that was one of the central themes of the book, the one I really wanted to explore. And of course, I don't think she found out for quite a long time what really happened.
Do we even know now?
I would say so. There were people would dispute it, but I think the clue lies in the Minarets convent, which was at near Aldgate Without, near the Tower of London. And it's all to do with Sir James Tyrrell's confession. Sir Thomas More names James Tyrrell as the man who actually organised the actual murder of the princes on Richard III's orders. And there are links to James Tyrrell and to people who were in the Tower who were in the position to know. And Elizabeth was in touch with the abbess of the Minories at that time. She and Henry VII were at the Tower at the time Tyrrell is said to have made this confession. I think there is, and so I think we do know what happened, yes. And I think that Thomas More, who wrote his history, also knew someone at the Minories. So that is where the key to the mystery lies. I firmly believe that.
We love a mystery.
If it was shown evidence that it wasn't right, then I'd be going with that.
That's the fun thing about these mysteries, is there's always new evidence turning up and always things to...
You can only go with the evidence when it comes to something like this. You cannot just start with a theory and try and fit the evidence around it. I mean, I had someone post on Facebook a little while ago saying, oh, I know it was definitely Richard III. I know I've read it. It's in The White Queen. I thought, what the hell? How good a novel it is? It's a novel. You cannot rely on my novel. You can't rely on anyone's novel. And somebody else said Richard III didn't do it. He was such a nice man. We don't know he was such a nice man. We don't have enough evidence to say that. And this is what concerns me. You know, we don't know these people. They lived a long time ago, and the sources for them, for their actions, are nothing like they are 50 years later, for Henry VIII's reign.
I have equivalent horror stories of people attributing or misattributing quotes to historical figures, not least Wellington, that I will save for another day. I want to just kind of circle back ever so slightly and sort of wrap up Elizabeth's story, if we can, and just sort of ask, because we were talking about, you know, those latter years of her life, how she coped with the death of Arthur, her son, which happened only a few months before her own death, if I've got my dates right. So
10 months beforehand, yeah.
How does she die? What is the cause of death? Do we even know that?
We don't know exactly. I mean, the problem is there isn't much of a description of what actually happened. She died in childbed, but she died a little while after the child was born, on her 37th birthday, actually. Now, there is a theory, and it's a very credible one, that she suffered from iron deficiency anemia, because repeatedly pregnancies can drain a woman of her reserves of iron, and it can lead to all sorts of complications. That can mean difficult pregnancies, it can mean premature birth, which happened with Arthur, because that's the first child, but also it can lead to perinatal mortality and maternal death. And this is what happened, because the child she had in the Tower of London, she wasn't prepared for it. She was going to be confined at Richmond, but the child clearly came early in February 1503. The child was a daughter, Catherine, and she lived about less than a month. And Elizabeth started to recover, and then she became seriously ill. And there was clearly a panic, because her physician had actually gone home to his house at Gravesend. And Henry VII summoned him back. You know, he was going to send escorts and people with torches to light his way and fast boats and everything. But he got there too late. She died.
Gosh, what was her funeral like?
Lavish, very lavish. We actually have an illustration of it. And it was a ceremonial procession. Thomas More wrote a wonderful eulogy and about her. And there was a huge national mourning. The king was devastated. He put on dark blue mourning, which was the colour in those days of royal mourning, and retired, you know, into privacy, because he wanted to be alone to grieve. And his character deteriorated in the years after her death. He reigned for another 7 years, and there was talk of marrying again, but it never happened. And But he must have missed her. I mean, his world must have been very empty without her. And that there was talk. He was close to, wait for this. And there'd been a pretender, Perkin Warbeck, who had, pretended to be Richard, Duke of York. And Henry plagued Henry for about 7 years. And up to Warbeck's execution in 1499. And but Warbeck was married. He seems to have taken in the Holy Roman Emperor, the King of France, the King of Scots. Although, of course, perhaps they were happy to be taken in to discountenance Henry VII. But he'd been given a kinswoman of the King of Scots to marry. Her name was Catherine Gordon. Mm. And when Perkin Warbeck was captured in 1497, his wife was taken too, and she was brought before Henry, who was very, very gentle with her. And Sir Francis Bacon said, you know, it was to please his eye as well as his fame that he was nice to her. And he gave her a lavish wardrobe. He sent it to wait upon Elizabeth. And after Elizabeth died, they were so close, it was thought they might marry, but it didn't happen. So this is the only hint that Henry ever looked at another woman other than his wife, but whether it went beyond looking is very unlikely.
Wow. Do you think Elizabeth took her in because she was his brother's wife?
Well, this is it. That was the king's idea. He sent her to wait on his wife. Mm-hmm. And she Elizabeth clearly liked her. Catherine Gordon became very popular at court. And there's no hint of scandal attached to her name. But one wonders, Henry treated her like this because she was a king's woman of the King of Scots. Mm. And at this time he was planning to marry his daughter Margaret to the King of Scots. And clearly want to be on good terms with him. So looking after the King of Scots, with James IV, you know, kinswoman is one way of doing that. But Elizabeth, one wonders if Elizabeth wondered, is he? Because at this point, she hadn't actually seen the pretender, and we still don't know what she thought made of him when she did see him, because it's not recorded. But there was, Henry had evidence that he wasn't Richard Duke of York, and he was actually the son of a customs master at Tournai. And so, and there was probably Richard III's sister, Margaret of Burgundy, was perhaps behind this imposture. But one wonders if Elizabeth entertained some doubt. Would she have known her brother after all those years? Her brother disappeared in 1483. She saw Perkin Warbeck in 1497. 14 years. Would she have known?
It's such a what if. I've always tried to imagine if I would recognise my brother at 12, if I'd recognise him 14 years later as the man he grew into. And
because men fill out and they become more angular, you know, their features harden and that, you know, and that. But I mean, look at pictures of my own daughter who at that age, I'd still recognise her now. She's in her 30s now. Mm-hmm. But I think it might be more difficult. And if you look at the drawing of Perkin Warbeck, my God, you can see Edward IV in him. Mm. But he could have been a bastard, but it's very unlikely. It's a happy coincidence that he looked like him, and that's probably why he was pounced on.
Of course, because as we know, all English people are now descent from Edward IV. Because absolutely, yes. He did plenty.
Bit of a boy, yeah.
Alison, this has just been... it's been brilliant. It's been such a riot.
Thank but before so I've enjoyed it very much.
Before we let you go, I just want to ask a bit of a funny, if I may. You're massively widely sold, hugely well known, legions of fans. Do you have any sort of crazy fan stories to share with us? Any sort of funny moments, any sort of quirky little things that, you know, you're happy to let loose into the world?
Now you've asked me. I've had various hairy experiences. One was it was the university bookshop in Seattle. And I was doing an event during an American book tour. And we're talking about Mary I, and we were talking about how kings and the Reformation and kings and queens decreed literally what people would believe and how they would worship. You know, we had the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation. I was talking about this, and this man who was of Middle Eastern appearance in the audience suddenly started saying, was it right that kings and queens could dictate this people's beliefs? And I said, well, right or not, it happened. We're looking at it, you know, from this perspective. And he would not let it go. And it got to the stage, I couldn't shut him up. And it got rather scary because the organisers, I had a media escort with me. She was looking nervous. And my husband was getting concerned. And this guy was holding a carrier bag. He kept putting his hand in it. And I could think, oh, my God, what have you got in there? Right. My husband thought he had a bomb. I thought he had a gun. They wound up the event because clearly people's heads were buzzing to and forth between us. I'm trying to get this guy to shut up and he wouldn't. They wound up the talk and I had to sit in the corner with a queue along one row of bookshelves and I felt very exposed. Everyone else got up and either joined the queue or left. He just sat there. And my husband was sitting not far, keeping an eye, watching him. And he was still putting his hand inside his carrier bag. And in the end, he wandered off and looked around the bookshelves. And I thought, he's waiting for me. He's waiting to pounce for some reason. I was really frightened by them. And the media escort, the bookshop proprietor, said, with the manageress, as soon as he nipped off to the loo, they dashed me downstairs to the car. And we really belted it away. And they even changed the restaurant. Wow. So it was a bit scary. Probably it was quite harmless, but you just don't know in these situations. And then I thought the hotel was haunted when I got back. We won't go into that.
Gosh, that sounds amazing. I mean, we were just thinking, you know, the purists trying to take you down because they didn't like what you said on page 31 about a belt buckle that wasn't, they wouldn't have had at that time. And
you get that. I mean somebody wrote to me once and said about my book on the Prince in the Tower, which is now retitled Richard III and the Prince in the Tower in the wake of his bones being found. And she said wrote, this was the age people wrote letters, and there's only one place for your book on Prince in the Tower, and that's the waste paper bin.
Nice.
So I said, well, fancy writing, taking the trouble to actually send a letter and stamp it and send that to someone, you know, feel like that. Good. And I know, because you can give two historians the same sources and they can come up with something completely different. Mm. It's all a matter of interpretation.
It reminds me of when we had Simon Scarrow on a few months back, and he was talking about how somebody had tried to take him apart for calling Duke of Wellington Arthur Wesley, because his name for a good chunk of his life was Arthur Wellesley. And the guy just completely got the facts wrong and hadn't realised that actually Wellington was born Arthur Wesley, and then the family name gets changed partway through Wellington's life. And so he, you know, Simon was saying, you know, this guy had clearly felt good about himself. He'd written his letter, he'd put a stamp on it. And you just think, what's the matter with these people that they need to
get a life.
Write like this? Exactly.
I know. I mean, I think you just have to respect other people have different views. And sometimes, I mean, I daren't post about Richard III on my Facebook page because Elizabeth I's appearing there now. And I've had some responses in there, and I could easily go back and argue. I don't upset people. If they're entitled to their views, but I know I could refute it with evidence. And then they'd probably come back with something else, you know. And some of it's based on something, in very slender evidence, you know. And I think, you know, if we go back to the sources, look at them, and then make up your mind, and then come and argue with me.
I love that. I think, yeah. Get your sources right, then we'll have an argument.
And if you still think it's right, well, fair enough. But not if you're coming up with something that I can clearly just say, well, I'm sorry, that didn't happen at that time.
And I think you're definitely right not to get involved on social.
Well, I don't upset anyone. I really don't, because I mean, I know what it's like. Especially, I would never give anyone a bad review for a book, because I know how much work goes into a book.
Exactly. There is one question that I want to end on, if that's okay, Alison, and it will be one that you've heard a million times. You're going to roll your eyes, but there's going to be somebody listening who would be really disappointed if I didn't ask you this question. So what advice would you give to an aspiring historical novelist?
Right. Show rather than tell, as I said earlier. That is very important, and let the reader see it happening. Don't just write a narrative, create scenes. So they feel it's real. And the other bit of advice is never give up.
Wonderful. I like that.
Hang on in there. I never thought it would happen to me, and it did.
That's a really positive point and a nice note on which to end. Alison, it's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much for giving up your time.
I've so enjoyed it. It's been a great, great fun. A really nice occasion. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Folks, you're listening to this. Elizabeth of York, The Last White Rose, is out now, because we're releasing it at the time that the book comes out. Head to the History Hack bookstore. We will have all of Alison's previous novels and historical works available to buy through that. If that doesn't take your fancy, you'll be able to find it in pretty much any bookstore that's worthy of the name. You'll also find details of Alison online on her website. Just Google the lady. I mean, she sold 3 million copies. She's very easy to track down. Alison, I know you're going on tour, aren't you? Are details of your tour online?
Yes, I am. I need to start a tour. Yes, there are. There's a website called Alison Weir Tours, and it starts next Monday.
Fantastic.
And we'll be announcing new tours in June for next year.
Brilliant. Alison, thank you so much for your time. It's been a joy.
Thank you very much, Zach. Thank you. Thank you, Charlie.